Boker Tov, everybody. Erev Tov in Israel. Just before we start this class on Amalek, Haman, and the ethical issues related to that, I just mentioned next week, we haven't even, this is the first announcement, after Rabbi Liebtag's class, Dr. Josh Berman, will be talking about biblical criticism. He just wrote a book published by Koren, on issues of biblical criticism, sort of an orthodox perspective. So he's going to be giving a one-time class next Sunday at 12:30. This class goes, let's say, 11:15 to 12:15 Eastern, and that will go to, you know, have a few minute break, and then he'll speak at 12:30. Shir Shirim, of course, is starting on Tuesday. Our Shir Shirim Yosefer Rubel starting a five-part series that we've sent out. But I just wanted to mention that right at the outstart. We'll send out an email a little bit later on. And okay, and then we have all our regular classes. Tomorrow, Malka Simkowitz will not be giving her class on the Apocrypha, but Simi Peters will be giving her class on Megillat Esther. So tomorrow morning or early afternoon, we'll just have the one class at 12:15 Eastern, and Mark Shapiro will be giving his class at 8:30. So that's just in terms of the schedule, and the rest of the schedule is the same. Thursday night Parsha Shir will be given by Rabbi Yaakov Trump, Rabbi of Young Israel, Cedarhurst Lawrence. So that's the schedule for this week. And with that introduction, Rabbi Liebtag, it's all yours to take away. Haman and Amalek.
This year is really special because every week from last Shabbos till Pesach, there's a special Shabbat, right? We had Shkalim, this week Zachor, then Shabbos Purim Mishulash, and then Para, Chodesh, Haggadah, and Pesach. That's it. So it's packed. So that's why I picked Zachor and the schedule. I'm going to finish my Megillah share. I started last week, next week. But I moved Amalek to today because I want you prepared for Shabbat Zachor. So let me share my screen. And today's class, we changed the title to make it Torah in Motion style. She asked me to make it more ethical. So was Haman the descendant of Amalek and the ethical questions of Parsha Zachor and Megillah. Okay. So I'm going to ask a couple of questions. You can participate a little bit. How do we know Haman was from Amalek? We'll stop the share for a minute. Oh, just for the fun of it. Does it say anywhere in the Megillah that Haman is an Amalekite?
From Agag.
Agagi.
He didn't say he's from Agag. He's called an Agagi. Now, I'm going to bring up a question, which we'll talk about more next week. How much is the author of Megillat Esther assuming about his audience's knowledge of Tanakh? I think we're up with the analogies last week when we talked about, I think I brought an example from Animal Farm. The question is, was the Megillah written for people who know their Tanakh, who know not just historical background, but are living in Tanakh in general? Can I expect my readers know Chumash, know the book of Zechariah, we'll see, and the book of Haggai, Ezra, Nehemiah, and things like that in that time period? In the same way, and when the Haman is called Agagi, was that written because that just happens to be his last name, or that was his ethnic tribe? Or is that a hint that there's something related here to Amalek? I'll leave that open. But the underlying question is, how come we're so sure that Shabbat Zachor goes together with Purim? In other words, our tradition is, but I'm trying to understand what makes that, we're in our tradition, where's the connection between Amalek and Purim? And what you said, Agagi, is any other than that he's an Agagi? Yabata?
Wiping out Amalek and wiping out our enemies. Because the way we were attacked, attacked, and we were weak in Persia, and so we were attacked as a foreigner. And the Amalek always went after weak, the doubt. People didn't know.
Yeah, we'll see that. But you said something in the beginning, which I want to talk about. Is any enemy of the Jewish people considered Amalek? Many people have said that. Can I call the Nazis Amalek? Would I call the Arabs Amalek? Would I call Hezbollah Amalek and things like that? Is any enemy who just hates the Jews and wants to kill us, is that by definition Amalek? Or there's nothing wrong with fighting your enemies, but But is that what Amalek is about? Is Amalek, by definition, someone who hates the Jews? Is he an enemy of the Jewish people, or is he an enemy of God? That was another another possible title. Amalek, an enemy of the Jews, or an enemy of God? So we're going to discuss that topic soon. Now, but another couple of questions to get going.
Question, going back to your first question, we have Mordechai is coming from Binyamin related, from the Sha'ul line, and Sha'ul was supposed to have eradicated all of Amalek, and he didn't. And that's how you have a God coming in.
Okay, but the fact that it's true that they might be connected, that it's true that Mordechai is from Binyamin, and it's true that his great-great-grandfather might have been Sha'ul. And it could be Sha'ul didn't do it, but is that the reason why, is that why Mordechai was chosen to fight Amalek? And is Mordechai doing the fighting? No, it's a nice connection, but I'm looking to anchor something. What makes them Amalek? Now, in general, if we have someone from Amalek, had he not tried to kill us, would we have been commanded to kill him? Let's say Haman was just an Amalekite and he did nothing wrong. Just you know, got in the government. Would we have been commanded to kill Haman just because he was from Amalek? And I'll give you another question. The way most people understand Amalek is that any descendant of the people who attacked us when we left Egypt, we're going to read that story soon, but when we left Egypt, we were attacked by Amalek, and we're told to remember what they did to us and wipe out their, you know, their memory forever. Now, if it's something genetic, meaning any descendant of Amalek who attacked us back then becomes Amalek, then number one, do we go by paternal lineage or maternal lineage? Or both? Anyone ever think about that? Let's say we're commanded. Let's say it's true. We have to wipe any descendant of Amalek. Do we go by the father or the mother, or does it have to be a pure blood? Did you ever see any halachic discussion of that question? Never,
doesn't,
right?
Doesn't the Gemara say that after Sancheirav, when he was Mabalbel, Kola Goyim, the Indian genetics didn't apply?
Yeah, so we're going to talk about that later on. I'm going to call that, the Gemara doesn't give a reason, it gives an excuse. I'll explain what I mean. I'll get in trouble for this. What the Gemara says, how about Amalek? So we don't fight Amalek anymore. Why? We don't know who they are. Because Sancheirav came and wiped and mixed around all the nations. Now, what I want to suggest, if that had not been the case, they would have found another reason not to kill Amalek. We're going to see, many times when the Gemara gives an answer, sometimes the answer is an excuse and not a reason. There's a much deeper reason, but that maybe one day we'll dedicate a whole share to that. It's an interesting approach in general. You'll see where I'm going with this as the share goes on. Now, but speaking of ethical questions, let's say there was. Does the Torah tell us anywhere, or is anyone before, but when Sha'ul attacks Amalek, is Sha'ul commander only to make sure that it's paternal lineage or maternal lineage or both, the pure blood? How do we know who's Amalek? If their only sin is the fact that their great-grandparents attacked us, how are we supposed to know? On top of that, how could we kill people for something their great-grandparents did, or great-ancestors? It goes against everything in the Bible. If someone's only sin is the fact of who their great-great-grandparents were, and any descendant of Amalek, no matter how good or bad they are, were hyped to kill them, it simply doesn't fit with the rest of the Bible. Again, it could be that some people might hold that anyone genetic descendant is by nature evil, but I don't think anyone Jewish could say that, especially after the Holocaust. In other words, how can you say that a certain people, they're just born and they're evil no matter what, and we have to kill them? That will go against everything the Torah is about.
But it's a chok.
When the rabbis, we never paskin to kill Amalek. No rab will say, oh, these Amalek, you have to kill him. So they always give an excuse why. I'm trying to give, there must be a much deeper reason why we don't do it. Now, to add to that, where's their land located? You can, in all the ancient people of the Middle East, I know where Egypt is. I know where Moab is, Ammon, Edom, you know, Sidon, Tsor, Sidon, Aram. There's nowhere on the map that you can locate Amalek. They're all over the place. Amalek doesn't have a set land. They were nomadic people. We find them coming out of Egypt. In the western Sinai, we find them later with the Meraglim, with the Mapilim, in the Negev. We find them in Eretz Yarden later on. We find them in Emek Yisrael later on. We find them in Tziklag. And they're just all over the place. So there is no one area. There's no defined geographic area where Amalek's located. They don't have a land. It was a nomadic tribe. So how am I going to keep track of them, not just paternal, maternal lineage? How do we know that they're Amalek? If we're commanded simply to kill people because they're descendants of the original Amalekites, it doesn't make sense thematically or ethically. It doesn't make sense practically speaking either. And it's a mitzvah d'oraita. The Torah tells us something we have to do. Now, again, what if they're not evil later on? Why do we have to kill them? Everyone knows that it's a mitzvah on the king. We'll see that in the Rambam. What's the source for that? And if it's true, why specifically does the king have to do it? Why can't anyone do it? If Amalek is evil and we have to kill them, why? The Torah doesn't say king. The rabbis understand it's a king. We'll see what the source is later on. But thematically, what does the fact that we have a king have to do with wiping out Amalek? Okay. And then, something we're going to read in Parashat Zachor that we don't pay attention to. What do we say? We'll read this in detail later on. But once we have rest from all our enemies, then we wipe out Amalek. How could that be? If we don't have any enemies, why fight them? And why does the commandment only begin when we have rest from our enemies? It should be whenever there's Amalek, get rid of them. What's that have to do with having rest from our enemies? And if we don't have any more enemies, then why bother with anybody? Okay, now, on top of that, again, let's say Amalek is Chayiv Misa. Whose decision is that? Who decides that Amalek? Every individual or Beit Din has to decide, the Sanhedrin? And let's say it's found, who's commanded to execute them? Okay. On top of that, there's a law of why can't you take the booty? We'll have to talk about that later on. And if it's an eternal commandment and they're one genetic people, then once, let's say Shaul wiped them out. Let's say he killed Agag also and no one was left. There wouldn't be an eternal commandment to kill Amalek afterwards? Is there spontaneous generation from Amalek? No. How could there be an eternal commandment for all generations if God commands us to wipe them out? Once we wipe them out, it's a one-time commandment. We're commanded to wipe out the seven nations. That's a one-time commandment. It's over. That's it. It doesn't apply anymore. But why is the mitzvah of Amalek an eternal one? Once they're wiped out, we should be finished. It could be we didn't do it. So those questions have to make us reevaluate what's going on with Amalek. Okay. Now, also, we'll talk about in the Megillah later on, why we don't take the booty in the war. We'll get that in the end. So now, we're going to get to the Megillah by the end of this year. If I don't, let me just check this chat real fast. See, people probably answering. I've been asking too many questions. And their land. Okay, good typo. Okay, that's true. I'll fix the typo. That was a computer question. Okay, just the typo. That's not a problem. And okay, iPad. Maybe there's a deeper, plausible answer because some parts of the Torah seems Chazal was illogical. Okay, that's a classic approach, which is it might seem to us illogical, but there's some infinite wisdom in the Bible that we can't understand. The Torah says they're evil, they're evil. It might go against our logic, but we have to accept it because it's in the Torah. I want to suggest that approach is not logical. I'll try to explain why. So I want to begin simply with the biblical sources. Bhatia mentioned something about attacking unprotected people. I'm assuming you're aware of this part of the shir, so I'm going to do it quickly, just to review. I'm assuming that idea, I'll prove it real quickly, but I'm assuming most of the people listening to the shir are aware of that. But before we start, I want to quote the Rambam. Okay, what's the Rambam say? The Rambam in Hilchot Malachim, in the very beginning of Hilchot Malachim, remember the end of Mishneh Torah, it's the last set of laws in Mishneh Torah. What's he saying? Shalosh mitzvot nitztavu Yisrael b'shachin satan la'aretz. There were three commandments the Jewish people were commanded when we entered the land of Israel. To appoint a king. Okay, now that's a big argument among commentators, but Rambam holds we were. To wipe out Amalek, which therefore the assumption is after we have a king, we can wipe out Amalek, but without a king, we can't wipe out Amalek. And to build a Beit HaMikdash. And of course, why can't we build a Beit HaMikdash without a king? And why can't we build a Beit HaMikdash without wiping out Amalek? And we'll see, we'll have to see, why is the Rambam tying all these three things together? Okay. And then it says also, there's a mitzvah to say, La Beit Zer Amalek, It's a mitzvah to say, not just one of these three. And in addition to that, there's a mitzvah to remember all the time all the terrible things they did to us. So we're always angry and disturbed by it. And remember what God did to Amalek. It's all quoting from the Psukim and Devarim we'll go to. Okay. On the other hand, he says, you don't go to war unless you offer peace. And therefore, he solves the problem of if they're not, you know, if they don't want to make peace, we attack. If they want to make peace, it seems like we don't attack. Now, I'll try to return later to this Rambam. And what's this idea that it requires a king? And first we have to have a king, and then we get rid of Amalek. We'll try to see the source for that soon. Now, just quickly, the first time, we find Amalek actually in Sefer Bereshit the first time. People don't realize that. But in the War of the Four Kings and Five Kings, there's a big battlefield. And the battlefield is called as Sadeh Amaleki, which has really changed because Amalek wasn't born yet. Later on, Amalek is a great-grandson of Esav, or possibly son of Esav, you know, born from Timnah, his Pelegesh. So if Amalek isn't born until Esav has grandchildren or grandchildren, how is there in the time of Avram Avinu, before Yitzchak is born even, how can we have a Sadeh Amaleki unless it's describing something that when Chumash is written, when we get the Torah Har Sinai, it's referring to some concept, which we'll get to soon. But the first Amalek story that we have in our commandment is after we leave Egypt, on our way to Har Sinai, and everyone knows we run out of water. And we're traveling from place to place, and everywhere we go, God's giving us another challenge, a test to get us ready for Har Sinai. And we travel from Midbar Sin, where we had the man, and we go to Rephidim, and there's no water. And of course, God wants us to ask for water, but it's not what we ask for, but how we ask for it. So the people complain. Moshe complains to God, give me a solution, and listen carefully to the solution. Pasukim. V'yomer Hashem Moshe, avor lifnei ha'am, v'kach mitcha mitznei Yisrael. Everyone knows that Moshe here is going to take his staff, and this time he's supposed to hit the rock. But pay careful attention to where the rock is. The nation is in Rephidim. God tells Moshe, pass in front of the people, take your staff with you, the matcha shekita batayor, take it with you, v'alacht, and take a walk. Moshe is supposed to take some elders with him and his staff and take a walk where? Hinni omei lefanecha sham al atzur b'chorev. I'm going to be at Har Sinai. Chorev is Har Sinai. Moshe has to take a day's walk from Rephidim to Har Sinai to hit the rock and get water. V'kita batzur v'yatzur mimenu mayim v'shata'am. That's what Moshe is commanded to do, and that's what Moshe does. Now, what's the question? If the people are in Rephidim, dying of thirst, and the water we find, which is going to solve the problem, is only in Har Sinai, which is a day's walk. We read last week in Parsha Yitro that we traveled from Rephidim to Har Sinai, and that was the last journey before we got to Har Sinai. Assuming it's at least a several-hour walk from Rephidim to Har Sinai, it's definitely not the same spot, then the entire nation has to move now from Rephidim to Har Sinai to receive water. And that's why Har Sinai first is a source of water before it's a source of Torah. And the whole nation is moving from Rephidim to Har Sinai to get water. But because of the situation they're in, the people who are weak and tired are lagging in the back. The stronger people went ahead probably to get water and bring it back for the week. But there's pandemonium in the camp. And all the leadership is now by Har Chorei, by Sinai, getting the water and first quenching their thirst and bringing back water for the people less fortunate and less able to travel quickly. And when does Amalek attack? Amalek attacks specifically now, not when we leave Egypt right away, not when we're in Midbar Sin, not when we're in an organized camp and we have an army and we're armed. It's when we're weak and they're not attacking the strong part of the camp. They're attacking the weak part of the camp, as we'll see soon in Parshat Zachor. But this background, as we're walking to Har Sinai, thirsty and tired, without water, the weaker people in the camp are lingering behind. And that's when Amalek attacks, when we're vulnerable. And then first God tells Moshe, go fight Yeshua tomorrow, because it's going to take a day to get the army organized. And the rest we know is history. We'll see this repeated in Parshat Zachor in a minute. In fact, let's go read Parshat Zachor. I see there's a lot. I'm going to take a quick break and just check Parshat the chat real fast. in case I missed something important. Okay, we'll talk about those. Okay, we'll get to the chat parts later on. Okay, now, in Sefer Dvarim, I'm just going to take the famous part of Parshat Zachor. Again, I'm assuming everything I'm telling you, you're mostly familiar with. God says, remember what Amalek did to you when you left Egypt, on the road of Egypt. Asher korcha baderech, which means he attacked you, sort of, on your way, when you're traveling, and he attacked the back of your camp. He took the tail of your camp, all the weak people in the back. Right? You were tired and thirsty. Fits nicely. And then the famous line, V'lo yirei Elokim, which according to almost all the Parshim is referring to Amalek. It's not that we were not yirei Elokim, but Amalek was not yirei Elokim. We'll talk about this phrase in a minute.
I can't do it.
I don't do it.
Let me do a quick mute. Okay. We got to be done. Okay. What's V'lo yirei Elokim? We'll talk about it in a minute. But then the famous line, when God gives you rest from all your enemies around, okay, then you wipe out Amalek and make sure not to forget. So two things. Why only after you have rest from all your enemies, you wipe them out? And how can it be mitzvah forever? Now, this idea of lo yirei Elokim, I can bring, it's used many times in Chumash, especially in Sefer Bereshit, a little bit in Shemot. It's used almost exclusively in relation to non-Jews and their moral behavior. We'll just bring a couple examples we have right here. The famous one with Avimelech. Avimelech takes Sarah. Avram says, it's my sister. God saves Sarah from Avimelech in a dream at night. Avimelech gets really angry at Avram. Hey, what did you do? How come did you lie to me? What does Avram explain to Avimelech why he lied? V'yomer Avraham, ki amarti rak ein yirat Elohim b'makom hazeh v'arguni al devar ishti. Avram was assuming that in the land of the Pishtim, there's no Yirat Elohim. He's not expecting everyone there to be Jewish or, you know the God of Israel, be ardent monotheist. But Yirat Elohim seems to be referring to basic moral behavior, like the fear of God, even small g, or the fear of gods even. The phrase that Chumash uses for basic good moral behavior, that if there's a society where people are nice and kind to one another and don't do evil things to one another, they have Yirat Elohim. If someone like leaves their change on the counter, the checkout lady is going to go and return it to them. That's someone with Yirat Elohim. Someone who has the fear of God in them, as opposed to someone who's evil and takes advantage of vulnerable people. So here, that's one example of Yirat Elohim. The example I like most is with Yosef himself. Yosef accuses his brothers of being spies. He says, you all go to jail until you prove to me you're not spies. What was their cover story? Hey, they say, hey, we're brothers. He interrogated them. In their interrogation, they had to tell the truth. And they said, you know what? We have one more brother. One brother's missing. We can't bring him. But one mother's backed by his father. One brother's backed by the father. He says, send one brother. Remember? He says, send one brother out. The rest of you, the other nine, are going to stay in jail until one brother comes back with Binyamin. So he puts him in the jail, Bishmar, for 3 days. And then Yosef has a change of mind or change of plan. What does he do? V'yomer aleihem Yosef v'yom ha'shlishi zot asu v'chiyu et Elohim ani yarei. I'm a God-fearing person. If you're true, and then what's his new plan? You know what? Only leave one brother in jail and all nine of you go home and bring food. How does Yosef, who's hiding the fact he's Jewish, introduce himself? I'm a moral, just person. I'm not going to do something mean to you. I'll be kind. What am I going to do? Instead of putting you all in jail and only sending one brother back, I'm going to leave one brother in jail and send all nine back. But he introduces his change of heart of being kind as I'm a Yirei Elokim. So it can't be a way of describing someone who's Jewish because Yosef's hiding the fact he's Jewish, but it seems to be common nomenclature when you want to describe someone as a God-fearing person, a nice person, doesn't do something mean, that's Yirat Elokim. And then finally, the best example, didn't bring it here, but I'm sure you remember from the Me'adot HaIvriot, the Shifra and Pua. In Pshat, they're probably Egyptian, but they're commanded by Pharaoh. They're in charge of the birthing hospital, and they're charged whenever a male child is born, when the baby comes out and is born, and you have to decide whether it's going to live or not, pretend, if it's a male, pretend it's dead and throw him into the river. In other words, try to make it look like a stillborn. And therefore, he tells the mialdot to curb the male population, and any male child, just throw him in the river as though he was stillborn. Why don't they do it? Because v'tiren hamialdot et Elohim, they have the fear of God in them, and they don't listen to Pharaoh. Whether they're Jewish or non-Jewish, if Shir from Purim Pshat might even be non-Jewish, but they're in charge of the birthing hospitals, and they're defying Pharaoh, but the reason they're defying Pharaoh is because they have Yirat Elohim. Now, you could ask me about the Akedah, but that I have a different explanation where God realizes that it could be, even though you're a Elohim, you still were willing to sacrifice your son. That's a complicated Shir on the Akedah. You can deal with that later on. Now, I want to go back and stop my Shir for a minute and go to Sefer Devarim, because we're in chapter 25 in Sefer Devarim. I want to go to Sefer Devarim, chapter 24, before this all began. There's a law in chapter 24, towards the beginning. What does it say? Here, Pasuk Tetzayin, chapter 24, Perek Haftalah, Pasuk Tetzayin, verse 16. Lo yumtu avot abanim, ubanim lo yumtu avot. It's forbidden to execute parents for the sin of their children, or children for the sin of their parents. Ish bechato yumato. People can only be punished for the sins that they do, not because of the parents or not because of their children. How would you apply that to Amalek? Now, you could say in the Ten Commandments, it says what? God punishes, you know, 3-4 generations. God can do that. But we can't do that. Beit Din can only punish people for what they do wrong. God is allowed to, but we don't understand the ways of God. But God is allowed to. And knowing that God could punish your children or grandchildren for something you do wrong might keep you on your toes. But Beit Din can't do something like that. Now, so there, that gives another reason why, and this is the chapter right before Amalek. Now, to show this idea of ethical behavior in relation to Amalek, I want to call what's called Smichut Parshiot, the Parshiot next to each other. Parshiot Amalek is in chapter 25, verse 17, Pasuk Yitzayim. Look at the law that follows it right beforehand. What's it say? Pasuk Yit Gimel. It's the law that precedes Amalek. Lo ya b'chischa eden v'aven gdola uktana. You can't have in your pocket different weights. It doesn't mean a rock, but a rock which is a weight. You can't have two rocks or two weights in your pocket, both say 1 kilo. One really weighs 0.9 and one weighs 1.1. And when you're buying and selling, you switch the rocks. That's a way to rip people off. And the same thing when it comes to dry measures. You can't have dry measure, both saying 1 efa, which really 0.9, the other was 1.1, and you switch them when you're buying and selling. Okay. Instead, even shlema v'tzedek yelach, all your measures have to be just and correct. We have to repeat it twice. That's a repeating phrase all through Sefer Devarim. We have it in the Ten Commandments as well. If you want to stay on your land, not you, the person, but you, the nation of Israel, is if you want to stay in Israel and not be sent to exile, if you want to stay on the land which God's giving you, you better have a just society and have just weights. The rabbis take it even farther. Not only can't you do that, but rather you can't even have a weight that's not exact in your home. It has a din of idol worship, if I'm not mistaken. You're forbidden to have any non-exact weights in your home, even if you don't use them. Now, what's Chumash saying? Now is it wrong? Ki tuavat Hashem Elohecha ko se'ela ko se'ava. It's not just something wrong to do, it's an abomination in God's eyes. A toiva is something which is disgusting. Like the arayot are called toivot, but this is more than that. This is something, an abomination in God's eyes. These are things that make, like to us, seeing a father sleep with his daughter, that would be a toiva. Incest is something which is disgusting to the average thing, a person sleeping with an animal. Chumash calls this toivot. But it's called a toiva. This is worse. This is toivat Hashem. The way we view incest is the way God views someone doing unethical business practices. Now, the next law is Amalek, but if someone has false weights, who can he use them on? You know, if you're a shrewd businessman, you'll catch the guy. But if you're in the marketplace and you have phony weights, it's very easy to take care of innocent people and vulnerable people. Some of those people are not going to pay attention. It's easy for the taxi driver to switch, you know, change the meter when there's a tourist or a someone that doesn't know the laws of the country. And therefore, that type of behavior is what, you know, if you're God's people, that's the last thing you should be doing. So I'm just showing you that the law that immediately precedes Amalek is one about moral justice and ethical behavior. So those are all my questions. And actually, one last source I want to share with you. If you have time in Sefer Shmuel, when David goes to fight together with the Plishtim against Shaul right before the final war on the Gilboa, he and Achish with the five leaders of the Plishtim, he's almost going to war with them, but he turns around at the last minute because they don't trust him. But his camp was in Ziklag. In Ziklag is in the south in the Negev. David, with all of his men, went to battle. No one was left behind guarding the women and children. What did Amalek do? Amalek attacked at Ziklag. That was when there's a war going on between different countries. What's Amalek do? They don't come to the battle. They come to the home front and they attack women and children when the men are going to war. So that's how they make a living. What I want to show you is Amalekites is a nomadic tribe, and the way they make a living is by attacking unprotected people, especially unprotected travelers. And there's a story when David finally chases them, he catches one of them, then not Amalekite, he catches someone who was abandoned and sick and almost dying. And they bring him back to life to give him some water. He had eaten in 3 days and he had fever. And David asks the guy, where are you? Who are you? And what's he say? He went, Nar Mitzri Onochi, Eved Lish Amaleki. I'm an Egyptian, but I'm a servant to or a slave to an Amalekite. What happened? Amalek, he was stolen and became a slave. But his master just abandoned him because he got sick. He got sick, so leave him there in the desert to die. That's typical of Amalekite behavior. They steal people, and when they're no longer useful, they just let them die. And then he says, David says, yo, show me where they are. He says, swear to me you won't bring me back to my master, and I'll help you with whatever you want. Now, the famous thing, we'll get to Shaul fighting Amalek in a minute. But all I want to establish is that what I want to suggest is that Amalek is not an ethnic group of people. It might have began as an ethnic group of people, but it becomes symbolic of a type of behavior where a group of people, by profession, attack unprotected people. Now, people can have countries and have border disputes and go to war. That's the way of civilization. But when I have a nomadic tribe that their entire economy is based on attacking unprotected people, that seems to be Amalek. And that's why there'll always be Amalekite-type people, because you're always going to find people attacking, taking advantage of unprotected people. For example, why is Amalek always found in the Negev and in the desert and the Sinai? We don't find them in the mainlands. We might find them in the mainlands when there's a war going on, so they'll be taking the home front when men are out to war. But because Israel's located on the crossroads of the Middle East between Mesopotamia and Egypt, and there's lots of caravans traveling and people traveling, especially in the Sinai Desert and the Negev, the best place for Amalek to make a living is along those trade routes in the desert area. That's where we find them in the Sinai. We find them in the Negev. We don't find them in populated areas. We find them in unpopulated areas where people travel. And you can't put a soldier every 2 meters to protecting international highways. And they're basically, it's international piracy taking advantage of unprotected travelers. Now, what's this have to do with the Jewish people? If what I'm suggesting is that Amalek is a type of behavior, I'll give a really bad example. I'll give a terrible example, but I hope you understand what I mean. From what I remember, if you look up the word Jew in a Webster dictionary, it'll give you several meanings. The third meaning has nothing to do with being ethnically Jewish. If you rip someone off in business, it says you Jewed somebody. If you do a trick on someone and rip them off in business, that's called he was Jewed. Anyone ever heard that definition before? Like, don't Jew me? I'm hoping one day that'll be an old meaning. But the fact that becomes synonymous with being Jewish That's one of the worst report cards we could possibly have. If that becomes typical of Jewish behavior, because that's exactly what Amalek is about. And if we're known for that, that's something we really need to remember all the time. So but what I'm getting at is that sometimes you can have an ethnic group that acts a certain way, but that name of that once whose ethnic group becomes a typical name of a behavior. I don't want to talk about New Yorkers. Again, good Samaritans, a good behavior. Next, but I'll give a better example. A Kanani. Remember in Eshet Chayo you might have sung last night or 2 nights ago? Chagor not ala Kanani. Kanani there means a merchant. Why does Kanani mean a merchant sometimes in Tanakh? A Canaanite might be a Canaanite. But a Canaanite can also mean a merchant. Why? Because the land of Canaan is located along the international highway. And it's a merchant line. And therefore, if you think Parshanim say, when Yehuda goes to Adulam, to an Ish Kanani, it's not necessarily a Canaanite, but rather to a merchant. Because merchants travel in the Middle East, especially between Mesopotamia and Egypt, and it's a merchant land, the land of Canaan. Therefore, a Kanani can be a nickname for someone involved in business. Now, with using all those assumptions, what I want to claim is that calling someone a Malek is a type of behavior. To explain why Sha'ol is commanded, once he becomes king, to wipe out a Malek, and why it's only once we become an enemy, I want to make my key point now. I want to compare a Malek to international piracy. If you remember, what's that movie called? Pirates of the Caribbean. They're pirates, right? So maybe you feel bad for those guys because the movie makes them the good guys. But in real history, the Pirates of the Caribbean or the pirates over the high seas were the greatest threat to international shipping, weren't they? What were they doing? The whole commerce was developing. With moving, the road was developing and becoming industrialized with international shipping. And what was the biggest danger in international shipping? People moving goods. Any pirate could attack a ship and make a quick buck. And therefore, it was very difficult to send goods because there was a good chance you'd be robbed. Who was able to wipe out piracy on the high seas? If you watch Pirates of the Caribbean, the British Navy. What enabled the British Navy to do it? Because they were a navy. They were a strong country. What I want to explain is phenomena like Amalek cannot be stopped by an individual. There's always phenomena like Amalek. You're always going to find groups of marauding people taking advantage of unprotected people, like piracy, stagecoach robbers like in the Wild Wild West and things like that. Unfortunately, there are always going to be people like that. They don't make a normal living. They make a living by taking advantage of unprotected people. That's their whole way of life. The only way you can save yourself from there, you can protect yourself, hire an armed guard or pray. To wipe that out, you need a sovereign country with a strong army. Only once you're sovereign and you have a strong country, only a country with an army and a strong economy, they have the resources to wipe out Amalek. And I want to make now my key point. What's Chumash telling us? When we're establishing ourselves as a nation, time of Yeshua, conquering the land, becoming a nation, we have to deal with our own problems. Once we're established and we conquered our land and we have rest from our enemies around and we've established a kingdom and we're sitting pretty and our borders are safe, that's not enough. We still have a responsibility now that we have an army and we're a country and we're sovereign. Because our land is located along the trade routes of the Middle East, the land of Canaan, which we're settling and conquering and setting up God's nation, because we're God's nation and people acting like Amalek are enemies of God, not necessarily our enemies. That type of behavior is an enemy of God. And because we're God's people and we're living in the Middle East and in the Middle East because of the geography and its nature, and especially the Negev and the Sinai, it's so typical for nomadic tribes to act like Amalek. It's our responsibility, once we have a king, to wipe out that type of behavior. And so instead of, it's not a vendetta, it becomes virtue. So That's going to explain two things. It's going to explain that difficult line by Yabaneh Hashem Elokecha Mikol Vecha Misaviv. Why is the commandment only when we have rest from our enemies around? Then we wipe them out. Because then we have the ability to wipe out Amalek. And that explains why it's a commandment on the king. It's not the king because, oh, he's got a robe in it. What's it mean once you have a king? When you have a king, that means you have a strong central government. Now, the first time we find a Navi, or God, commanding anyone to wipe out Amalek is going to be Shaul. But let's open up Sefer Shmuel now, and we'll see something really interesting. We'll share my screen, and we'll go to Sefer Shmuel. Here we go. We are in our Bible. And Shmuel Aleph, open up chapter 14. At the end of chapter 14, it's a set of psukim in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yedaled, psukim that a lot of people aren't familiar with. There's a couple of lines about how good Shaul was with his army. People don't realize how good a king Shaul was in the beginning. It says as follows. Here we go. Pasek Mem Zayin, towards the end of chapter 14. V'Shaul lachad et hamlucha. Shaul was able to take over the kingdom, over Israel. V'ilachim saviv b'kol eivav. See that phrase? He fought all his enemies around. All the enemies of Israel he fought. B'moav. That's all of our borders, isn't it? Moab is to the east, as well as Ammon. Edom is to the southeast. Sova, that's Aram, to the northeast. We had peace relatively with Lebanon at the time. Plishtim was to the west. Everywhere went. And also, he fought Amalek and saved Israel from all of its enemies. And then we summarize his kingdom, who his wives were, who his children were, who's in charge of his army, and there was always a state of war with the Plishtim at the time. Now that Shaul is established as a king, and he's defeated all of his enemies around, that was in chapter 14. Now chapter 15 begins. What does Shmuel tell Shaul? God sent me to anoint you, and now listen to the commandment of God. I'm remembering now what Amalek did to you when you left Egypt. Not, I found their descendants. No, oh, I found a descendant of Amalek. Now you can go wipe them out. Now that you have peace from enemies around, I remember the commandment I gave you, that it's your job now that we have a king and we have a monarchy and we have a strong army, we can fight Amalek. Vatalech v'kitat Amalek. Now go fight Amalek, right? And get rid of everything they have. Remember, and don't have mercy on them. Now, this phrase, which is probably the most difficult, in Chumash, there's never a commandment to wipe out women and children of Amalek. There's a one-time command in Sefer Shmuel, which I'll try to explain in this thematic meeting. Wipe them out, male, female, baby, you know, nursing child, even older animals, donkeys and camels. Why such a wipeout? Now, I want to suggest that this phrase is there for thematic reasons in Sefer Shmuel. Because I have almost the exact same line later on in chapter 22, if I'm not mistaken, when Shaul, for political reasons, is angry with Novi HaKohanim. Remember that story? And what does he do? Remember Novi HaKohanim, they gave David bread when David was running away? And Shaul was saying, how come no one's telling me what's happening? And finally, Doeg Edomi, he's the one who Shaul commands to kill the Kohanim of Nov. So he, Doeg, Vaisov Doeg, Vaifgabo, Huva Kohanim, Vaimot Bayomahu Shmonim, Vachamisha Ishno Seifod. He kills, for political reasons, 25 priests in the city of Nov. And then listen to the next line. Vet Nov era Kohanim, he kalefi Harev. Meish Vadisha, Meovavi Adonek, Mishor Vachamor, Vesedlefi Harev. Almost the exact same wording. I call that Gzera Shava. There's a lot of things in Shmuel which are written for thematic reasons, like saying Shaul was only 1 year old when he became king and he reigned for 2 years. There's sometimes exaggerations in the book of Shmuel which are there for a thematic reason. But because Shaul ultimately sins with the way he chases David and the way he does these political actions and killing a whole city because of his political enemy, that's going to be the fall of Shaul. But the fact that later on we're going to describe his wiping out of Nover Kohanim with the same phrases, that's going to be the basis of a midrash that teaches us that anyone who has rachmanut on the achzarim is going to end be achzari on the rachmanim. Remember, anyone who's going to have mercy on people who are evil ultimately will do evil to people who are merciful. So that's an insight on the book of Shmuel, but that's a very complicated shir on the book of Shmuel, which I want to leave alone for now. What I want to simply show you is that in the commandment in chapter 15 in the book of Shmuel, to wipe them out, is not because these are descendants of the same people who attacked us coming out of Har Sinai. There's a group of people in the Negev. Remember, they're fighting them in the Negev, and they're acting like a Malek of Chumash. And this wipeout, the way they're commanded to wipe them out is an exaggeration, but that's a build-up for what's going to happen later with Nover Kohanim. Shaul is not punished for not killing Olel V'Adunek. Shaul is not punished, oh, you didn't kill all the women or all the children and things like that. He's punished for something totally different. Now, he goes to war. He tells the king to go away. And the name of the king is Agag. Okay? He's king of Amalek, and he keeps him alive. Why does he keep him alive? He says as follows, Ve'achmo Shaul va'am al Agag va'metav atzon. Shaul has mercy on who? On Agag and on the sheep. Now, I want to compare the two. Shaul and the people don't have mercy on the sheep. They have mercy on their stomachs. Because what's the law? If Amalek is a nomadic people stealing and robbing from unprotected travelers, then if you attack Amalek and take the booty, you're dealing with stolen goods. So if possible, return it to their owner. But if you can't, you can't keep it. If you attack Amalek for their bad behavior, and then you keep the booty of the battle, then you become part of the food chain. Therefore, there's a special law with Amalek. You can't take from the booty. Why can't you take from the booty? Because it's stolen goods. And the booty belongs to God. In what sense? It's an enemy of God. You're fighting God's wars. The booty belongs to God. You want to dedicate it to the temple? No, that's a machloket. You have to get rid of it altogether. When it says lachrim, does it mean lachrim and use it for the temple, or lachrim and throw it to the Dead Sea and can never be used? Ask your local rabbi for that one. But the main thing is you can't keep it. You can't use it for yourself. Because once you take the booty of Amalek, again, you become part of that food chain. In other words, when you fight Amalek, it's a different battle than fighting a regular enemy because they're God's enemies. And when people come home from a battle of Amalek and they don't take the booty, people can ask, hey, usually you win a war, you come home with booty. If you come home without booty, it looks like you lost. What do you have to explain to people? Oh, we didn't take the booty because this is God's war against Amalek and they're special, and that there can be an educational message of winning a battle against Amalek and not taking the booty. Now, how do I know that Amalek at the time are actually evil? First of all, they're in the Negev, right? They're in the Negev. They're fighting in the Negev, you know, in the south. Again, Amalekic territory. We said that before as well. And then Shaul and the people don't have mercy on the sheep. They have mercy on their stomachs. Meaning, why have all that sheep go to waste? Why can't we eat them? So the lousy sheep, oh, they get rid of. But the good sheep, they save it. But how are we allowed to eat it? Oh, let's call it a korban for God. But a korban shlamim. So they dedicate all the sheep. And they don't care about the sheep. They're going to kill the sheep. They care about their stomachs. In the same way, Shaul leaves Agag alive, not because he wants to leave him alive. I want to prove to you, why kill Agag in battle? I can kill him in public and make a big show out of it. The same thing that Shaul was afraid of, why commit suicide later on? Because when you catch the enemy king, you don't kill him in battle. You catch him alive, you parade him around, and then you kill him in public as a show that you won the battle. It's like a great show. It's a great way to celebrate a victory by catching the other king or the general and killing him publicly and getting all the credit. And we're going to see Agag is taken captive in order to be killed publicly. And there's going to be a national celebration. This will be the Haftarah we're going to read on Shabbat. There's going to be a national celebration in Gilgal that everyone's invited except, of course, the chief rabbi Shmuel. And what's Shaul planning on doing? Everyone's invited to celebrate the victory over Amalek. And the big event will be the execution of Agag. But because everyone's invited, we have to feed everyone. So we're going to have korbanot from all the tzon, from all the sheep. So God tells Shmuel, but Shaul's done the wrong thing because I wanted him to defeat Amalek and not take any booty. And Shaul's worried about his pride. We'll see in a minute. The main thing Shaul wants to look great, and that's going to be Shaul's underlying problem. It's his kavod, it's his glory, which is important to him, as opposed to God's glory. King David, when he wins wars, everything's dedicated to God. When he wins battles, he builds a mikdash for God, and he puts God at the center of his kingdom, as opposed to Shaul putting the kingdom, or his own self, at the center of the kingdom. Now, what does Shmuel tell Shaul? No, he tells him, Shaul says, Shaul thought he was doing the right thing. He was sure he was doing the right thing. But Shmuel tells him, you're wrong. Now, listen what God tells him. Here. Pasuk Yudchet. Vayishlacha Hashem badarach, v'yomer lech v'chramt et hachataim et Amalek. Go kill and wipe out the sinning people, Amalek. Amalek is punished for their sins, not for because of their great-grandparents. And fight them and wipe them out. Wipe out that phenomena in the desert. You'll see later on, if a God was the only one who remained, then how come a couple years later, David is chasing thousands of them in the Negev when they attack Siklag? One night, a God had 5,000 kids one night? And in 5 years, they all grew up? That's impossible. Amalek's over the place. There's always different types of Amalekic tribes. It wasn't that everyone was wiped out except Agag himself, Imshat. But we see that they themselves were sinning. What's the biggest proof? When it's over, how does Shmuel minimize damage? Shmuel ends up, Shmuel wants to leave, but Shaul begs him to stay. And Shmuel said, I'm not going to come with you because God's angry with you, but he tries to leave. And remember, he rips his coat, doesn't let him leave. Finally, what does Shaul say? Vayomer chatati, oh, Rabbi, I'm wrong. Ata kadenina. He's worried about his honor. Honor me in front of the elders of Israel. The whole nation is gathered for this big ceremony in front of all the people and come back and bow down to God with me. Words, come back and be part of the ceremony. And Shmuel is reluctant to leave, and he returns. Vayeshav Shmuel, Achrei Shaul, he actually returns to the ceremony with Shaul. Shaul continues bowing down to God, but how does Shmuel minimize the damage? Shmuel returned, he says, bring me Agag. Instead of Shaul killing Agag and getting all the glory, now the chief rabbi is going to kill Agag. In other words, Agag is going to be killed, not because he was a lousy general. Agag should be killed for war crimes, for an ethical crime. And we're going to see this in what Agag himself says. Okay. So what does Agag say? So Shmuel says, bring me Agag, I want to execute him. Ve'elech Agag, and what's Agag say? Vim Agag. Achein sar mar hamavet. What's that mean? When Shmuel comes to kill Agag instead of Shaul, and I want to prove that he knows he's a dead man, he knows he's dying. He says, the pain of death, the bitterness of death is now gone away. Why? If Agag is killed by his fellow general Shaul, he looks really bad. If Agag is to be killed by a rabbi for an ethical crime, for what he did wrong, okay, he knows he's a bad guy. The bitterness of death, he knows he's dying, but instead of being executed by a fellow king, he'll be executed by the rabbi, by the Navi Shmuel. And listen to what Shmuel says. Why is Agag being executed? V'yemer Shmuel, kashir shiklan nashim charbecha, kein tishkam b'nashim imecha. Your sword caused many women to lose their children. And Im Shukla is a mother who loses her child. Your sword caused many mothers to lose their children. You were killing people left and right. You're an evil person. And now my sword is going to cause your mother to lose her child. And Shmuel cuts off his head. And Shmuel goes back to Ramata. Without going to the topic of Sefer Shmuel, what I want to show you here is that Agag is being punished not because of his great-great-grandfather, not because he's a descendant of the rich Amalekite. His behavior is Amalekite behavior. And God wanted the king to wipe out Amalek as enemies of God and not take the booty and not to make celebrate it and not kill the king in public and get all the glory for himself. He wanted the glory to go to God. And unfortunately, Shaul misunderstood Shmuel. Again, a topic for the book of Shmuel and why David is chosen over Shaul. But I don't want to go too much in detail there because I want to get back to our topic about Malek and get back to Megillat Esther finally. So I'm trying to explain why we need a king to wipe out Amalek, and why it's a mitzvah only after we have rest from our enemies around, and why it's virtue and not vendetta. And then I don't need to know is it paternal descent and maternal descent. And I don't need the ethical problem. I'm not punishing anybody for what the great-grandparents did. That goes against everything else in Judaism. I'm punishing people for their own deeds. And my point is that the reason it's a commandment on the king of Israel or on the government or the sovereign land of Israel, once we're able to help the international community and wipe out international piracy, because that type of behavior is an enemy of God, we as God's people have the ability to do that. And if God gave us a kingdom and gave us a land and is blessing us with sovereignty, and we've established an army and we have a strong, solidified country, we still have a responsibility to the international community as well to clean up the international highways, which we're living right next door to. Now, how does that make Agag? I'm going to finish in a minute and I'll take all the questions. Let me go back to my, that share and go back to my, I'm pretty sure I covered all our sources. Now we got to go back to Megillat Esther. What makes Haman Amalek? What was Agag? Let's take a look at Megillat Esther. Share my screen again. And let's take a look at Megillat Esther is right over here. Chapter 3. We're using Ala Torah Tanach, still a bit ahead. Listen in chapter 3 to the first letter. V'nishlach sfarim b'yad haratzim, amidot ha-melech ha-lashmid, la-rog ha-labed, ekoi di minar v'atzakein, taf v'nashim b'yom achad, everyone knows this, on the 13th day, in the 12th month, 13th day of Adar, in Chodesh Adar, and loot and booty, whatever you want. In other words, all year long, the Jews are protected by Persian law. Now we have an edict going out, an official edict of the government, that on a certain day, on the 13th of Adar, what would be the status of a Jew anywhere in the empire? Any Jew in the Persian Empire will be unprotected on that day. And anyone who wants can kill, rob, take out, loot them, ushlam levos, and take their, you know, take and loot them, and nothing will happen to them. And it's the official document of the Persian government. Now, if that is the edict that's going out, that's the first letter. What type of people? Now, it doesn't say you're commanded to kill all the Jews. I'm saying, he says anyone in the Persian Empire has the right now to do anything they want to any Jew anywhere, to kill, to destroy, to steal, to rob, anything you want. Like they're, it's like saying, it's like taking Lahavdil Kristonach and saying, maybe even not Lahavdil. Is it on this night, Jews are unprotected. You can break their stores, rob their things, kill them, and the government won't do anything about it. The Persian Empire was rather organized. But specifically on that day, anyone has a right to kill a Jew. What does that mean? Anyone attacking a Jew on that day would be acting like Amalek. Why would someone attack a Jew? Hey, easy prey. So what I want to claim is the first letter going out is setting up an Amalek type situation. Maybe I'm pushing things a little bit, but that's what I want to see in the first letter. The first letter, in essence, is saying on a certain day, anyone who wants, the Jewish people are vulnerable. Okay, now, what does the second letter say? Anyone remember when the second letter goes out? Remember what chapter that is? Remember, the first letter goes out. When was the letter sent? Take a look at the date when the letter was sent. On the 13th day of Nisan, the first letter goes out with this gzerah. In chapter 8, make sure it's still there. In chapter 8, Megillat Esther, after the whole thing's over, you know, Haman's gone already, but Esther wants to undo the gzerah of Haman. So we get a second letter. What's the second letter say? Right for all, did you remember, I can't take back the first letter. Look when the second letter goes out. On the 23rd of Sivan, the second letter goes out. Now, what takes so long? Haman was killed according to, if you follow the story in the Megillah, you know, a couple of days after the first letter goes out, sometime on Chol HaMoed Pesach. And it takes, and this is like express mail, it takes another 2 months to send out the next letter. How many days pass from the 13th of Nisan to the 23rd of Sivan. I'll do the math real quick. There's 17 days left in Nisan, 30 days in Iyar, and 23 days in Sivan. Altogether, 17, 30, and 23, 70 days. There's 70 days that goes back to our share last week. For some reason, the Jewish people have this feeling we're about to be wiped out for 70 days from the first letter to the second letter. And if that relates, maybe it could be by chance, but those 70 days might be a hint or alluding to Yirmiyahu's 70 years. That was just a little side point, as long as we're mentioning the letters. Look at the second letter. What does it say? What can the Jews do? Now they can gather and protect themselves. The first letter says you're not protected. I can't undo that letter, so anyone still can attack them. But the second letter says, you know what? Now the Jews can protect themselves. Anyone who wants to help them can help them protect themselves. And now that we can save ourselves from anyone attacking us. But therefore, the people who are going to go and attack us on that day, based on the first letter, are hoping and assuming the Jews are unprotected. The second letter allows the Jews to protect themselves and anyone must help them. But I'm just saying, I think what makes Agag, what makes Haman, it could be that maybe that's why the Megillah calls him an Agagi, to connect it to our story with Agag, the king of Amalek, the Shoal fights. But if I'm looking for that type of behavior in Megillat Esther, then for sure we find that. In fact, the opposite of that, our Jewish behavior will be exactly the opposite. What do? We do Maton Levionim and Shloch Ma'ish L'Reyu. We're doing the opposite. We're carrying a Jew. When he sees someone vulnerable, unprotected, he's always there to help them. It's 23. We'll do the Cheshbon Amin. I'm pretty sure it's 70 days. 23. Someone said it was 60, but is it 70? 13, 30, and 23? Is it 70 or 60? I think it's 70.
It is 70.
Okay. Yeah. I don't have a calculator. Okay, we're good.
I mean, the 13 to 2 months, 13 to 60 at 10. That's the other
That's way. Right. That's the easy way to do it. Good at math. Okay. Now, so let me, I'm pretty sure, that's what I wanted to cover. I know my time's way up because I have a lot of questions to answer. But that's what I'm trying to get across in Megillat Esther. If the topic wasn't really Megillat Esther today, just use that to try to explain where I find Haman in Megillat Esther. Next week, we'll talk about this whole mitzvah of Mishloach Manot Ish L'Reihu. Next week, we'll see that the author Megillat Esther is assuming the reader knows his Chumash, the reader knows the Navi Zechariah, and knows what's happening in the book of Ezra in the earlier chapters. That'll be next week's show. That'll be the fun one. We put the whole Megillah together. But what I'm trying to explain is that the way we're explaining Amalek, it has a lot to do with sovereignty, doesn't it? That's our underlying topic. Remember from Lord Balfour from King Cyrus, Lord Balfour. Remember we did Haggai and Zechariah. We're hoping to return to sovereignty and it's not happening. So we're surviving without sovereignty. But our goal is to be a sovereign nation. And what do you do with your sovereignty? Is Jewish sovereignty a reward for good behavior? You keep mitzvot and you get to run your own country. Or is Jewish sovereignty in a land a tool through which you serve God? Can I sanctify God by having a sovereign nation? So if I have a nation, not just individuals acting properly, if I have a nation that cares about international good, I have a nation that dedicates itself to solving a problem of international piracy. If I have a nation who uses its national institutions for the betterment, not just of its own country, but of other nations, we'll see that in Tehillim. We're going to see that that's David's goal for Malchut Shlomo. If I have a nation being a light to other nations, then I can sanctify God not only by my individual behavior, but also by my national behavior. Now, once you have your own nation, you can become corrupt and do terrible things, and you can desecrate God's name. But you also have the potential to sanctify God's name. So since we're talking about sovereignty and the idea of return to sovereignty in the Second Temple period and returning to sovereignty in our own time period, to understand that Jewish sovereignty is not just reward for good behavior, but rather it's a tool. God wants us to be a nation. And if we're responsible enough to use our sovereignty properly, then that sovereignty, our national institutions, can sanctify God the way we run our country, our judicial system, our political leaders, our health system, our social justice system, there's how we go to war and things like that. And in certain ways, maybe it's good we're held to a higher standard when we go to war. But when if I understand Amalek the way I'm trying to explain it, then Amalek is in sync with all the other values of the Torah, being a light to other nations, caring about other people, protecting unprotected people, kindness and justice, and as ethical as can be. In that sense, and why do we have to remember that? Because there's any ask any Hasidic Sharov, there could be an Amalek in every one of us. It's to wipe out Amalek, like getting rid of your chametz kind of idea. It's so easy to take advantage of vulnerable people. I don't want to call about white collar crimes and things like that. But if you know the whole subprime, you know, remember from about 10 years ago when the whole economy crashed, that's when, you know, you can easily in business, you know, you can try to make it an honest living, that's fine. But when you're purposely giving a loan for someone to default, right? To take advantage of a poor person, so default and lose his home, that's the most rotten thing you could do. And that's got to be as anti-Jewish as possible. I'm not saying you have the din of Amalek, you know, you're chayav to kill people like that. But the laws of Amalek can remind you that type of behavior. And that's why the laws of unjust weights, which is a way of ripping people off, is the next door neighbor to the laws of Amalek. Okay, so now we can go back and hope my point was clear enough. Now let's see how much trouble I got into. Okay. Let's go back.
No trouble.
I'm going against all that.
This, obviously, all parts of Torah, everything has to be ethical in the Torah. There cannot be something unethical in the Torah.
Okay, the Good Samaritan. I'm sorry, that's good. Yeah, the Good Samaritan, because also it's about behavior. Very good. David, about David's instructions to David about executing. That's then all those questions are questions. That's a shir on the book of Shmuel. There's a question about the book of Shmuel. The fact that David does something doesn't mean it's always the right thing to do. You know, some David gets complained to by a Navi a lot. But his instructions to Shlomo could be understood in many ways. What happens next? Okay. Let me see what other questions are word. Okay, that but what makes a good, the expression the first time is a real estate lady. Oh, about being Jewed. Okay. I'm sure it breaks the anti-Semitism as well, but you don't want to give them fuel. Okay. Didn't Shmuel tell Shaul to destroy it all? Now, it doesn't say anywhere. When you wipe something out, I'll try to explain what I mean. Sometimes Chumash talks to exaggerations, like Shlomo married 1,000, like 300 wives and 700 mates, pilakshim, whatever they're called. I'm assuming that that's an exaggeration. Many times in Tanakh, we have exaggerations to make a point. And how do you know it's an exaggeration? When it's an exaggeration. It doesn't make sense. You want to wipe out a Amalek. So the way you say wipe something totally out, total wipe out, like when you, I'll give a terrible example, when you have to remove a tumor or something. So you take out everything. You follow? You don't take any chances. You just, a total removal. So you want to talk about how to wipe out a phenomenon and not do a half a job. Amalek, something evil, you got to wipe out that phenomenon altogether. It could be that's the way the Torah talks. Now, on top of that, that's a one-time commandment to Shaul in wiping out Amalek. The commandment to Shaul, me ish v'adisha me'olavi ad yonek, is not an eternal commandment in Shulchan Aruch. It's a one-time commandment for Shmuel. That's not in Chumash. In Chumash, we remember Amalek. You know how many mitzvot of memory there are in the Torah? Again, we didn't have time to do this, but remembering the Exodus, it's about behavior, isn't it? We remember how we were mistreated and we don't do that to others. Why should Amalek be any different? We remember what Amalek did to us and we don't do that to others. But Jewish memory is learning from your experiences and growing from them. If you suffered, learn from that and don't do that to other people. It's not about vendettas. And just like all through Sefer Devarim, remember you were slaves in Egypt and therefore don't treat the vulnerable people in a bad way, you know, go out of your way to help them. Remember how you suffered and don't let other people suffer. In the same way, remember Amalek did to you and don't you dare do that to other people. And therefore, there's a commandment to remember Amalek even when you can't, you know, do anything about it, because that's going to build your behavior. All the memories are going to be transformative memories that shapes our behavior. Remembering how not to behave is super important. Now, it could be once we have a nation and we have a king and we have rest around, we can help the international community That's, you know, far in the future. But remembering every year and all the time, it's one of the six schirot. All the other schirot, remembering Matan Torah, remembering what happened to Miriam. It's not Lashon Hara about Miriam. It's remembering from the story of Miriam not to speak Lashon Hara. Every memory you have in Chumash, every Zachar, is transformative. Remembering an event that shapes your own behavior. It's not about vendettas. You know, you're not supposed to remember, oh, Miriam was such a terrible person. No, Miriam was a great person. But remember from that story about how not to talk Lashon Hara. Remember from your experience in Egypt, not to mistreat, you know, the orphan, the widow, and the stranger. And be nice to your workers and things like that. And remember from Amalek, how to remember what happened at Har Sinai. Remember also from Amalek, all those memories transform your day-to-day behavior. And that memory, the way we've explained it, is critical in behavior. It's, of course, don't do evil, but remember that type of behavior. That's a toiva. That's what God is abhorrent in the eyes of God. Taking advantage of someone unprotected, that's antithetical to Judaism. And that's very different than having a vendetta from thousands of years ago that these people are genetically, you know, bad, and we have to search people from, you know, the thousands of years ago attacked us from Har Sinai, and we have to take, you know, all generations, kill their descendants. It just doesn't make sense practically. It doesn't make sense ethically. It doesn't make sense with all the other themes of the Torah. Okay. Yeah, for again, it wasn't a kosher sacrifice, but that's what, if I was having a chance to teach a Sefer Shmuel, but my claim is Shaul, King Shaul, is sure he's doing the right thing, and he doesn't agree with Shmuel's reproach. He'll finally say, okay, Rabbi, I'm wrong, but he goes on with the show. In Shaul's eyes, he's king, and the rabbis just went berserk. He doesn't accept it until the day he dies, the day before he dies, he remembers, oh my gosh, that old rabbi was right. But that's, again, the theme. That's a classic Sefer Shmuel. Why Shmuel killed Agag to deprive Shaul's... Yeah, Shmuel kills him to make it publicity about God and not about Shaul. That's right. And that's why he loses his kingdom, because he doesn't... It's not because he sinned, because he doesn't understand what it means to be king of Israel. Okay, so I'm saying, how is killing young children... line with that... There's no mitzvah to kill young children. And sometimes saying that statement, wipe out from young to old, is that a mitzvah to wipe out young children? Now, there's another question in the Seven Nations, why wipe them out? That's a famous moral question. That's a one-time commandment, which we don't follow by. That's something God commands. It has to do with how people went to war in ancient times. But I don't think God ever yells at us for not killing young children when we go to battle. Again, poked avon avot is something God can do, but something we don't do that. Okay. Questions? Does anybody on the list have the same take on it? Not that I've seen. Most people say it's a concept. Like a lot of people say it's a concept and not a thing. What I was saying before, that the rabbis know that we don't kill people for something their parents did. So they always find an excuse not to wipe out Amalek. So they say, you know, Sennacherib came in. It's a nice, easy answer. That's a lot easier answer, saying I can't fulfill it, so don't worry about it. But I think deep down they know that maybe Rabbi Joe will give a share on that one day. You know what I'm talking about, Rabbi, right?
Of course, of course. Yeah.
The best example is, what's it called? Mishum Eva, you know, and things like that. Like, why a Jew, let's say a non-Jew, his life is in danger, and you have to mechallel Shabbos to save his wife, right, to save his life. So do you mechallel Shabbos? Halacha says no, but of course you do, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't because you're Jewish, right? You save his life. Now I don't need a reason. The reason is because you're Jewish. I need a halachic excuse, Mishema Eva.
Rabbi, that's the famous story. I'm sure you know it better than I. Rav Ami telling Rav Lichtenstein if they were on a desert island. You know that story.
You can
tell that story. I'll let you.
Would you eat another human?
I mean, no.
Do you eat treif?
The story, as I heard it, is they are on a desert island. A Jew, you're a Jew, and there's a non-Jew on the desert island. He's dying, and it's on Shabbos. Would you save his life? So Rav Lichtenstein, the story I heard,
Rav
Lichtenstein said, I would save his life and do tshuva. Because after all, because there's no Ava, nobody would ever know, right? The situation is, the halachic justification is nobody, it's bad relation. No one ever finds out. Really, so yeah, of course I'd save his life, but I'd do tshuva, providing the halacha. And Rav Amital said, I would save his life and I wouldn't do tshuva. It's a beautiful story. It's the other story on the cannibalism, that's in Rav Amital's book, but that's we'll leave for another time, yeah.
Same, yeah.
But Rav Amital is saying, even though there's no prohibition of cannibalism in the Torah, clearly you for sure would eat treif of food than cannibalism, even though halachically speaking, cannibalism, because there's a certain moral sense that things are disgusting, even if it isn't in the Torah. The Torah is not the only morality out there, but that's okay. That's for more shirim and more discussion.
Okay. But speaking of chametz, like in Rambam and Weights and Measures, about whether you can't have in your home like an unjust weight, like a weight that's not exact. It's it has a din of idol worship. Yeah.
Rabbi.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that baderech betzeitchem mitzrayim also has to mean when we were vulnerable. This story of Amalek, where it says that didn't actually happen anywhere in the first couple of years. We weren't baderech betzeitchem mitzrayim then. Story of Miriam also didn't happen in the first. While we were on our way out, that it all happens at times when we were vulnerable.
Okay. I mean you're supporting what we're saying.
I'm supporting what you're saying and adding something to it, that this phrase, Baderech Betzeitchem Mitzrayim, does not mean literally. It seems to mean at times we were vulnerable.
I guess I'm on the way. Got too much. Okay. But somebody in the story of Fidim, we're mamash traveling. It's mamash, they attack us when we're weak and tired. Ayev usually means, remember, it means thirsty and hungry, like Hubam Yisrael Ayev. Okay, was the Rav who talked about mutual between God and Am Yisrael. I'm not sure. I remember, I think, from the Rav, I'm not sure, but I know a lot of people want to say that any enemy of the Jews is like, is Hasidin of Amalek.
That's the Rav Chaim based on the Rambam. The Rav would quote his grandfather that Amalek is a concept. And that they have no reason for hating the Jews. The Arabs have a reason. The Palestinians have a reason for hating the Jews. Some country that has zero reason for hating the Jews, nothing to do with them, and they hate the Jews, that's Hasidin of Amalek. That was Rav Chaim's.
Yeah.
Chiddush based on a Rambam, whatever. But
Alrighty. Anyway, any other questions?
Okay.
Or forever hold your swords.
No, thank you. You see, many, many people really like the shir very much. And I think it's, we don't perhaps do this often enough, speak about the ethical foundations of the Torah. And there are things that, I think for modern man sometimes are ethically troubling. And often people are afraid to speak about them. So I think it's good once in a while we speak about it. But like I said, I alluded to, I believe the Torah is the most ethical thing there can be. And we have to deal with those issues head on. And correct, no rabbi would say kill Amalek. It's just whatever.
If we were... And the fact it's in Sefer Devarim proves the point, because in Devarim it's less of how you go to war. All the laws in Devarim about how you represent God as a people, not just as individuals. And that's why the main law of Amalek is going to be in Devarim.
I mean, we know that almost whenever the Torah says kill people, we don't kill people. For half the sins in the Torah, you get a death penalty. But Rabbi Akiva said he would never give one. That's
Pshat Masechet Sanhedrin. Masechet Sanhedrin tells you, don't take the Bible literally. Take it seriously.
Correct. The Torah is written from a divine perspective and everything is strict justice. But we have a Torah Shabbal Peh to temper the justice with rachamim, basically. Al regel achat. Anyway.
But not to get to the point that you let people walk over you.
Right.
No.
All right.
When you have a real enemy, you can't be afraid to kill an enemy. Yes. Okay.
But thank you so much.
Have a good
thank everybody, Amalek.
And go back to the fun part about, we'll explain why we have Mishloach Manot, and we'll get, next week will be the most Zionistic year of the year, so beware.
Okay, that's good for those who don't live in don't live in Zion.
Oh, people enjoy feeling guilt. People enjoy, a lot of people like hearing,
Mussar.
Like feeling guilty, yeah.
But see, now they don't have to feel guilty because nobody
can go to Israel. Airport's closed, yeah.
The Israeli government won't let you in.
Yeah.
I hear the American government's already getting upset at Israel because they allow LL flights for emergency landings, but on American flights, I'm not. Anyways. All right. Okay. Looking forward to seeing everybody. Be well. Shavua Tov. Like I said, tomorrow, our next year is 12:15. Simi Peters on the Megillah. The shiur by Malka Simkowitz is taking off tomorrow. We'll resume next week. And then I mentioned tomorrow after Rabbi Liebtag's shiur will be the shiur by Rabbi Dr. Josh Berman on biblical criticism, another subject that people like to avoid very often. And
I get to listen. Maybe I'll do a rebuttal the week after. We'll see. Josh is my good friend.
You don't like his approach?
I do a rebuttal or agree on one or the other.
Whatever. For those of many of you, I'm sure.
We're good friends.
Yeah, in tradition, recently they had a review a chapter of the book. So he's going to be talking about, I think it's called How an Academic Bible Scholar Answered the Bible Critic, something like that. But you'll come next week, Rabbi Liebtag at 11:15, Josh Berman at 12:30, and Shira Shurim beginning this week. Yosefa Rubo, five-part series, beginning this week on Tuesday. I assume you know her too, Menachem, right?
Yes, sir.
Yosefa Rubo, right. So anyway, she teaches at Matan, and she'll be making her Torah Motion debut on Tuesday at 1:30 after Benny Gesundheit's Shir on Tehillim, which is at 12:15. Okay, we look forward to learning with you all during the week, and bring your friends and everybody be well and be healthy. And have a wonderful day. Bye-bye, everybody.